Yesterday on the show, we talked about the growing support for legalizing marijuana across the United States and the cannabis industry that's showing no signs of slowing down. According to the Marijuana Business Factbook, the projected economic impact of the legal marijuana industry in the United States could reach $77 billion by 2022. But that doesn't mean everyone is benefiting from the industry's record highs. Black people and other people of color who have long been targeted by law enforcement for cannabis use are facing significant barriers breaking into the legal cannabis business today. So we spoke with marijuana advocate, author of How to Succeed in the Cannabis Industry, and the cannabis program supervisor for the city of Portland, Oregon, Deshita Dawson. And I asked Deshita, what exactly does a cannabis program supervisor for the city of Portland do?
In essence, I oversee the Office of Cannabis Program Management, all the licensing and compliance, the typical things that one would expect with owning a business within the adult use or medical cannabis market within the city of Portland. But I also oversee the community education and cannabis competency and equity programs as well within my office.
So one of the big things we've been talking about on the show as we are starting to see more movement towards decriminalizing and making even legal in some states marijuana, particularly for recreational use, is that this is a huge business. And yet only 4.3% of cannabis business owners are Black. Talk to us about some of the major barriers that have led to that.
You know, unfortunately, we've seen a huge racial disparity in the arrests while cannabis was prohibited. And one of the biggest things that was part of policy when the industry was first being developed, certainly the adult use market, starting with Colorado 10 years ago, is to prohibit individuals with prior arrests and convictions as it relates to cannabis from being in the industry. And so that this just being the policy, you couldn't be a worker, you couldn't be an owner. We see a disproportionate amount of those people being prohibited being Black, Indigenous, and Latinx. And so that's a first real cause. But also the second, I would say, would be us, you know, not bringing ourselves to the table out of fear. Again, being over-policed and most likely to be arrested for cannabis possession as compared to white counterparts, despite no more usage, it is really ingrained, multi-generationally ingrained in Black and Hispanic communities that, you know, being anything part of marijuana is bad. And so it's been a combination of both just being purposely left out based on the way the law has been written, but also culturally it being something that remains in the underground and is frowned upon if brought to light or talked poorly about because of just the way its prohibition has impacted our communities.
Deshita, one of the most frustrating things about how marijuana policy in the country has evolved is that I often say, talk about how I grew up in the 80s here in New York City, and I recall witnessing the war on drugs, the effects of the crime bill, particularly in Black and brown communities that I grew up in, and seeing how many people were incarcerated for these crimes. And now, decades later, we're witnessing a sort of birth of an industry here that is largely concentrated among white owners and white business owners. How do we begin to get people of color the capital that they need to set up these businesses?
I think that's a great question. I'm also from New York. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. Grew up during the war on drugs. And so one thing I will say out the gate is that the industry has been going on for a decade in adult use, multiple decades for medical. And as recent as last year, there were videos of a young man getting assaulted by 7 police officers because he smelled like he had been consuming marijuana. So New York City still has a long way to go. And we're still seeing a lot of the unwanted police interactions as a result of the smell. And so I still think the fear is a really big issue, but the money is another. And that actually is in a lot of ways dictated by the government. New York's medical market, for example, only granted 10 licenses, which made it extremely competitive. We talk about awarding a license to do business as opposed to just having the requirements. And so the money aspect comes into being able to jump through all of the hoops that the government has set up as the requirements to get a license. How much you have to have capitalized in the bank and the like. And so then that leads us to an issue of who has the funding. And private equity funding in this country generally is run by, you know, white males. And women and people of color, specifically Black people have a very big struggle with getting funding for projects, period. But then you add the layer of cannabis and it becomes a very difficult thing to even get funding from within your own community of people who are willing to support. We're starting to see that change a bit. And I think the government has an opportunity to take the tax revenue and really reinvest it, providing some funding. But I don't think it's going to close the gap on what the regulatory, you know, framework calls for. So we've got to do both.
There's also the question of criminal background. And what I find mind-boggling is that someone could have done their time, have been incarcerated for marijuana-related offenses, is now out in this moment where people are taking advantage of the legal market to sell and consume marijuana. And yet those people who have been convicted of crimes are left out of the market, particularly because they have these convictions. Is part of the MORE Act, for example, attempting to expunge some of these records so people can get a foothold in a market?
Absolutely. I mean, I think over the last 3 years, cannabis equity has started to be defined, and it's defined around those most adversely impacted. And we know it starts with the individuals who were arrested and incarcerated. And so most of the really top equity programs in the country, Illinois, Massachusetts, California, even what's going on in Oregon, you actually have to have that previous record to be defined as an equity designated applicant. And that can give you anywhere from funding support to prioritize processing, a lower or reduced licensing fee. So in the state and local level, we've started to just change the way we think about the legality. The policy shouldn't be that those people are left out. It should be that we should be figuring out ways for equity to really be achieved. We've got to figure out how to get them in if they want to be in. To some people may have done all that, like you said, and they actually just want to open up their, you know, their another business, but they've not been able to get approved for funding because of their past. So to your point, expungement is really important, and the MORE Act, the acronym means opportunity, reinvestment, and expungement. And that expungement piece is something it does address. You know, we've, as the regulators in the industry, have been very critical of the MORE Act, though, since its passing, because there were a lot of language that we were surprised by that does the opposite of what we've been working on in the state and local level. So it expunges at the federal level, but doesn't expunge or mandate state-level expungement. And even in New York, we don't have expungement as a constitutional thing that we can do. And so in some ways, New York, you know, would need to be told by the federal government, hey, you need to create this and do it. And then there are other states that we just know would never do it. Georgia, Alabama, Kentucky, they wouldn't expunge without a mandate. And so you leave people, unfortunately, in that limbo state where they still really haven't gotten rid of their record. Because, you know, where I'm from, Brooklyn, if you got a federal case, you also got a state case. And it's like a 95-96% likelihood, especially in southern states. So we're seeing some of it be answered. But no, you know, my struggle is that we're not using common sense, you know, in our policy to fix this, even though we are admitting for the record, and that's what that historic vote did, that it should never have been illegal to begin with.
Now, the vote has a very unlikely chance of passing the Senate. The makeup of the Senate could change. We're all waiting to see the results out of Georgia to see which way the Senate goes. But it would still be a pretty close, the Senate, you know, would still be pretty close in terms of who has a majority and who doesn't, if it really hinges on one person being elected at this point. Are you optimistic that a Biden administration will somehow move forward some of the things that we're talking about at the federal level to make the act, the MORE Act, for example, less of a symbolic move and more of something that actually has teeth to begin to make some of the changes that we're talking about here on the show today?
I am hopeful. I mean, I think that Madam VP-elect Kamala Harris really, despite her history, right, like she arrested a lot of people in California, and we've in the cannabis industry called her out on it, but she came out to Colorado. She met with a lot of leaders within the cannabis industry. She gets it. And a lot of the laws she made as senator in California really has been precedent across the country. So she understands decriminalization. I think where they make the mistake is that instead of trying to free the people, they're really trying to free the plant and get us to the money faster, or the government to the money. And we need to first deal with the people. One, as just a consumer marketing expert before I got into the industry, I would say it would make the market flourish. More people from the legacy market or underground market would move over. But also, we were changing people's lives. We're making them more viable in employment and housing, all these different things that are insecure right now due to COVID. I think that she gets that. And I think that her influence on Biden, from what I can tell, means that he's going to be getting it as well. Do I think that they are going to fully legalize? I'm not certain that he's convinced there, but they don't need to. They need to decriminalize, stop arresting people, stop making things like what happened last year to that young man in New York City happen by just having ambiguity around whether cannabis should be illegal on the federal level. And now that the World Health Organization has descheduled it and removed it from its most dangerous category, which for them is a level 4, for us it's the schedule 1, but basically that means we have an ability and precedent to remove it. And that once it gets removed from schedule 1, it changes the federal landscape on whether we should be arresting people and using SWAT. And all of that is in line with it being dictated as a Schedule 1. So I think we're going to get there for sure. And I think that's actually in our best interest as Black and Brown folks to have it decriminalized, because, you know, the part that's really damaging us are the arrests, over-policing, the incarceration. It's removing people from the home and individuals coming out, inability to get homes and jobs. That's what's impacting our community as a whole.
The black market, Dashita, is where a lot of folks continue to get their marijuana. And I'm wondering, you mentioned opening this up could mean that people who are in the black market could then move over to the legal side of things. But I'm wondering, you know, black market marijuana will probably be cheaper than legal marijuana for perhaps a variety of reasons. And it's also a place where people have been able to make a living off of selling this on the black market. And I'm wondering how you see the black market evolving.
Well, I think it's been evolving, even in states where California is the largest market, but the legacy market, which is what I call it at this point because it existed before, it really is, it's still growing, it's thriving, it's actually benefiting from the decriminalization aspect. Where the government's missing out is the ability to create programs that have people cross over from the legacy market to the legal market. And what does that mean? It means that you're probably going to have some sort of business and tax structure type of programs. But I also think, again, not having it be so many hoops that people have to jump through just to get the license. Like if I'm just a distributor, AKA the plug, do I need to get all of this federal bond, all these licenses in order for me to just distribute? I'm not sure if that should be the case. And I think there are opportunities and things that I'm doing myself within Cannabis Equity that are intended to pilot, right? We got to test. We don't know what's going to happen without trying it. But to date, we haven't tried to actively just move the demand over by moving the market over. Instead, we've tried to just hyper-criminalize that market. That's not going to work. Our usage rate has not changed in 40 years, despite some of the harshest drug laws in the world.
And that usage rate, it should be noted, as you know, Dashita, that black and white Americans use marijuana at similar rates. It's just black and brown Americans are criminalized for it more than white Americans are.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, I think that that in of itself is the story behind cannabis. And when people of color actually recognize it, I think it changes their perspective that when you're getting involved, yes, there's a business opportunity, but there's a real justice component for the people who were most adversely affected and directly affected. But even for people like myself, I was never arrested, but I grew up and I watched people get dropped to the ground, you know, for a dime bag. And that to me, I think has a psychological effect on how we think about cannabis. And that ultimately is impacting our health. Because at the end of the day, this is actually medicine. We're talking about an adult use market, right? Or recreational, but the reality is the plant is still always medicinal, regardless of the usage rate. So it's a little bit of a personal fight for me as well as a cannabis patient. We need these markets to do better. And I think we'll do better by including the diversity that exists in the legacy market.
Dashita Dawson is the author of How to Succeed in the Cannabis Industry and the Cannabis Program Supervisor for the City of Portland, Oregon. Dashita, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me again. I appreciate the conversation. It was great.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.